This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note. I'm Jessa Rensselman. At the G8 and G20 summits, maternal health is one of the key issues on the table. Peter Driftmeyer spoke with Kasari Govender. She's legal director of the West Coast Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, or LEAF. He started by asking Govender what sort of impact decisions made at the summits can have on women's rights. Here's that interview now.
The G8, G20 are important meetings for global leadership. And as women make up more than 50% of the population, certainly the decisions that are made at the G8, G20 have huge implications for women around the world. In particular, Stephen Harper, our Prime Minister, has made maternal health a particular priority in this G8 summit meeting. And so it will have particular implications for that aspect of women's well-being.
And where do all the different participating countries stand on women's rights and maternal health?
Well, there's a range of different perspectives on maternal health and women's rights. And it appears that the outcome of the G8 talks will allow for a difference of opinion around funding for example, abortion and contraception. The Canadian government has said that funding abortion services will not be part of its contribution to a maternal health plan. They have said that family planning services and contraception maybe, but not abortion services.
This is a new policy of the Canadian government?
It is a new policy of the Canadian government. And it's a really problematic one from the perspective of both women's rights and women's lives and health. There is, the World Health Organization says that 13% of maternal deaths are due to unsafe abortions. So it shows that although ostensibly the government is committing to reducing maternal mortality, in fact, there's a huge gap in the way it's approaching that platform.
Just retracing our steps to the G8, G20 in particular, how would the decisions made there translate into policy on the ground?
Well, we expect that there will be an outcome document from the G8 that will outline what kind of finances will be committed. We're hoping that there'll be commitments made about how much money is going to be put into this plan and the parameters of what services this plan will be targeted at. So as I said, there's the leaked document that came out in early June seemed to imply that there would be some room for countries to decide themselves what their portion of the funding will go to, but Canada has decided that it won't go to abortion, and that will be written right into the outcome document of the G8. The promises that are made at the G8 are not at this point legally enforceable, but they do carry considerable weight in the sense that they are highly publicized commitments that our global leadership makes. So it really is important to determine at the outset what the coverage of these programs will be, and so that we can hold governments both to their promises and really pressure governments to make good promises in the first place.
But now this leaked document, it seems the Canadian government, their mind was made up before the conference.
Yeah, I think that it's clear, and in fact, the Harper administration has made very clear that that abortion was not going to be part of those services. So it's not really been a secret in any sense. They have said that they don't want to fund, they don't want to include controversial services in this platform. I think, again, that's a really problematic stance to take, given that people's lives are at risk. This is not about morality. This is not all about political choices. This is about real people and real lives and children without mothers and women dying. So they're not really in the realm of moral choices, and so I think the justification around not including controversial platforms really doesn't hold much weight.
Are there other countries that aren't avoiding this, like Canada?
I can't tell you about the platforms of other the other G8 countries or G20 countries. I can tell you that Hillary Clinton, obviously from America, has made very clear that they disagree with the decision of the Canadian government to exempt abortion services, that in fact abortion services are an essential part of maternal health plans. And it was one of the first acts of the Obama administration to reverse the Bush administration's position that they wouldn't fund abortion services in international development projects. So the U.S. government has taken quite a strong stance against this, and each government has sort of is allowed to make their own decisions under this new G8 initiative.
And if other G8, G20 countries want to put abortion on the table and have that maternal health component on the table at the G8, G20, are they able to do that, or do you think that's likely?
I think they're able to do that, absolutely, according to this leaked document. I think that doesn't change the fact that Canada is not taking that stance, yet allows, really there's a hypocrisy there, since abortion is allowed for Canadians or within Canada, and yet we're imposing this restriction on people in other countries who arguably in some ways have much more need for it given the risks around pregnancy and birth in countries without the kind of healthcare system that we have. So of course, while it's a human right everywhere, on a pragmatic basis, women are dying in great numbers around the world, and yet we allow women here to access the service and we're not funding the service around the world.
Are there any other particular women's rights issues that will be covered at the G8 G20?
Well, this is the one that's the most explicitly focused on women. As I say, all of the issues that will be discussed at the G8 G20 will have implications for women in the general population. One of the issues that we would like them to be discussing, certainly, is climate change. And I think that has large implications in relation to the maternal health scheme, because the maternal health scheme, Prime Minister Harper's justification, one of his justifications that he offers for not funding abortion is that other more pragmatic services like access to clean water will be funded. And we know that access to clean water is directly connected to climate change issues, and that developing nations are experiencing the brunt of a warming climate. And a warming climate means things like less access to food because crops are affected, less access to clean water because there's not as many sources for clean water. So there really is a direct connection between women and children being healthy and staying alive in developing countries and reducing global warming.
And will climate change be a hot topic at the discussion?
Well, there was some indication in the leaked document that it would not be a topic of much discussion beyond that climate change should not impact the economies of the countries that are working on it. So, a really problematic stance, partly because we, I think, should see climate change as a priority issue for human beings and for the world. But we also, it's also a bit of a misleading statement given that climate change is already affecting the economies of countries around the world, in that, you know, it affects the economies when people are not able to access food and water, and where transportation costs are going up, and in many, many, many ways, climate change is already costing people and countries more. And so to make this stance that it should not be affecting countries is problematic in a number of ways.
So these are very international decisions in their scope, and we're talking about big issues like climate change. It's international in scope, and maternal health. How does international law fit into this?
I think international law has a really strong impact both on what's happening at the table at the G8 and G20 conferences, but also in the public discussion about what people want to see at those tables. And I'll explain that a little bit. International law, international human rights law, I should say, is a set of both binding principles and what's called soft law, so more declaratory principles around what rights we each have as citizens and what rights we can enforce for ourselves against the government. But it really, in many ways, the practical reality of international law is that it's only as significant as we make it. So there is no international government exactly, and so there's nobody, in some ways, there's nobody to enforce these principles without a lot of public pressure. So I think it's really important that as individuals we educate ourselves about what rights we have internationally and really call our governments on it, because it's an important mechanism of enforceability for international law. So that said, international law is, international human rights law, I should say, is a series of international treaties, and Canada is a signatory to many of those. Those rights range from, there's a Bill of Rights on women's issues, there's a treaty that addresses children's rights, one that addresses economic and social and cultural rights, which aims a lot at issues around poverty. There's another one around civil and political rights. There's one against torture, and so on. So they address a wide range of issues. How it's really relevant to the G8 and G20 is that the governments are getting together to discuss economic issues and international development issues, among others. And I think it's really important that the decisions there are made through the lens of what rights do citizens have. And it's important not to lose that perspective when you're talking about money, that in fact this has real implications for people's lives, and in making these decisions we have to ensure that the governments are respecting international human rights obligations.
Is Canada respecting these international human rights obligations?
I think that they've got a long way to go in terms of living up to the obligations that they've signed on to. I think Canada's actions have been commendable in committing itself to many human rights documents, although there is one glaring omission, which is that Canada has not signed on to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is one of the soft law instruments I was referring to. So it wouldn't be binding if Canada signed on, but is a really important step in the global recognition of the rights of Aboriginal people. And Canada is one of the very few countries left that has not signed that declaration. Other than that, Canada has been at the forefront of many of the developments in international human rights law, and I think our legacy on that front is really something to be proud of. What I think is we shouldn't be proud of is the fact that we have fallen short of many of those obligations. So, for example, there are hundreds of women who, Aboriginal women across the country, who have gone missing or have been murdered, and there's been a real lack of public attention. And by public attention, I mean a lack of adequate investigation into these cases, and many of them remain unsolved. And the UN has drawn specific attention to this issue and said that Canada really needs to shape up and live up to its international obligations on this front.
And now, so this event that you were part of last Sunday was called At the Table,
mm-hmm.
and there were roundtable discussions taking place. What happens as a result of those roundtable discussions?
Well, the idea of the roundtable discussions was to have what they were calling a people's summit. So kind of to counterbalance the idea that the world's elite leadership is meeting, is to have to encourage the general public to have conversations about what issues are significant to us, what issues we would like to see on the international agenda. Each table came up with specific recommendations, and those recommendations at this point are being distributed through a number of networks to really raise awareness about those particular issues. The table that I was participating in at the Main Street Car Free Day on Sunday was talking about international law obligations and the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in particular, which is a bit of a mouthful. But we were talking about international law principles, and the two recommendations that came out of that were around violence against Aboriginal women and also around poverty issues. And so those recommendations, along with others, are going to be distributed around a number of civil society networks to really generate discussion about what we'd like to see at the G20 G8 tables.
And how do you gauge the success of this At the Table campaign, these different NGOs being at the G8 G20?
I think it's a really important process because it brought together many different partners. So it was a way to kind of organize some of the response of protesters and, as I say, concerned individuals. So I think it's already met with success in that it's generated a lot of conversation, and it's provided a channel through which to direct much of this conversation. I think we'll see some of that impact as the protesters and advocates kind of gather in Toronto and in Huntsville and over the next week or so, and really push for change. And it will provide people with some language around what the rest of the country is pushing for.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Kasari.
Thanks very much, Peter. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Kasari Govender, Legal Director of the West Coast Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, about maternal health and women's rights at the G8 and G20 summits. It was conducted by Peter Driftmeyer from Simon Fraser's CJSF-FM. This has been Needs No Introduction on the Rabble Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.